revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. All please welcome Henry from Miami. Thank you, sir, for joining us, and take it away.
All right. Thank you. Can everybody hear me okay? Good. Great. All right. My name is Henry Murphy. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 26, 2011. I'm a member of a home group. It's the Miami group. And we meet Monday and Thursday evenings at 8 p.m. in Miami. It's not just a clever name. We're actually in Miami. So that's easy. Has to be like that for me. I can mix up my left and right foot most days. Billy, thank you so much for reaching out. And I think we connected through my dear friend, Al Jay, who I love. And Al had the misfortune of being sat next to me at one of those AA like lunches one time. And I think he only had one ear left after I got done chewing on him for about an hour. And, you know, and he was just so kind. He just listened. I think he just like stared off into the distance and meditated until I ran out of gas. And then he was, but no, he's awesome. We love him. And it feels really good to be with my people, to be with everybody. And what I'll venture to do in the time that we have is maybe share with you the only thing I have of any value, and that's my experience. My experience as an alcoholic, my experience as a guy who had his first drink at the age of 12 and his last drink at the age of 33. And in between that time, I would seek every pill powder, potion, and lotion to fix my emotions I could get my hands on. And alcohol was everything to me. I didn't know it. Most times early on when it was happening, the absolute power and the effect it had for me. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that had I not discovered alcohol when I did, things would have ended up maybe even worse for me. Alcohol cured me. It resolved something in me that so desperately needed resolving. It was my power by which to live until it turned on me and then burnt the whole thing to the ground. So it's interesting. I've had a good full AA weekend. It's been really good. I got to sit with a guy yesterday and do an inventory. And the way it is in Miami, it's kind of, we're a little bit like a pocket of enthusiasm down here. All we've really done though is we've just sort of like opened up a franchise of my sponsors group. You know, it said, hey, what's your format? Carbon copied it. And we just got to work running around enthusiastic. Some days I don't think we know what we're enthusiastic about, but it's what we find here in AA and what all of you have sort of laid out for us. And it was a good inventory yesterday because it was a guy who was fresh. Like I am not, and I remember this mindset as a guy who would go in and out of AA, but I am rarely anyone's first choice sponsor. It's a little too extreme. I'm a member of that group. And if you go near that guy, you're going to be doing service. He's going to ask you to do all kinds of crazy stuff. Just stay away from him. Stay away from him. And then usually 3 months, 6 months, 9 months later, I'll see him back in the detox. And they're like, you're still here? You know, and there I am. And then eventually they come up. And so as a result, I'll get people who may have gone through parts of the process. But I had the privilege yesterday of a guy who was just raw, you know, coming in hot. All this is new and fresh for him. And it was a powerful experience. It drew me back. And so that and being able to be with all of you, I'm in good stead. I'm in a good place today. So just, I don't want any of you to think that I'm sneaking into AA for the bad coffee and uncomfortable chairs. You know, I want you to know that I'm an alcoholic and I'm an alcoholic by really the place that I lean on is certainly the doctor's opinion and the effect and bizarre relationship with alcohol that me as an abnormal drinker that I have, this this allergy of the body, this obsession of the mind, this spiritual sense of separation, it nails me. And then a more, I think, direct understanding of what I have going on for me comes out of We Agnostics. You know, the simple idea that when I introduced alcohol into my system in any form at all, I have little control over the amount I take. And when you get me physically sober, it seems to be that's when my problems really begin. Because over any period of time, if I don't change, I'm the same man. That same man has proven he always, always drinks again. It's the way it is. And what's interesting about that is it tells me, and it goes on to say that if I've got those two things going on, those two things that like punch my ticket for membership in AA, it doesn't say to stop drinking. It tells me I may be suffering from a malady or an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. And maybe I'll do my best to share my experience through that lens. If I hope to someday soon, maybe, and maybe you guys could be down here, but I hope to be in a meeting live with you guys, you know, and come up and see or see Al, and maybe if I was there and we were hanging out by the coffee pot, you know, not judging everyone, but just sharing, you know, accurate observations about our fellows, you know, we might be chatting it up a little bit as we like to do, and somebody might walk through the door. And it might be someone we haven't seen before. And if it's like my group, one of us or sometimes many of us will go up and introduce ourselves and maybe offer you a warm cup of coffee and a friendly welcome. And we get to talking. And I might tell you a little bit of my journey and you might tell me a little bit about your journey. And ultimately, it would emerge why you're there. You know, why you're at the AA meeting. How'd you end up here? And I don't know just by looking who's making their approach or who's been around a long time, but I'd talk to you and you might tell me a reason why you came. And if you're new or making your approach, I'll submit something to you only because it was true for me that the reason that you think you're here, it may very well turn out to be very, very different from the reason that you're actually here. The reason you think you're here may turn out to be very, very different from the reason you're actually here. It was in my case. And another thing a guy said to me that nailed me right between the eyes is I sort of had this kind of arrogant cavalier attitude about my alcoholism, almost as though to say, listen, okay, AA is a nice thing, but if I ever need it, it's always going to be there. Well, it's a great lie I tell myself. Because I've seen so many people walk out the front door, taking it for granted, assuming it's going to be there tomorrow, only to never be able to find the front door again. So a guy once looked at me and said, kid, is it possible that you're in a heck of a lot more trouble than you think you are? Is it possible that you're in a lot more trouble than you think you are? I looked at like, what's he talking about? What do you mean? What are you trying to say? And God, he was right. I was in a level of trouble that I couldn't comprehend. I was far gone from my ability to pull myself out by human aid. Then I had no clue that I had no clue, and I was gone. And so that's one version, but I'll tell you like my relationship with alcohol. And God, I want you to know I love alcohol. I love everything about it. I love the ceremony. I love all the fancy accessories. Now, I never really got to use them because I was sort of like, how did I drink? Well, out of the bottle till it's gone. I'm like an out of the bottle till it's gone guy. I love the look of those scotch glasses. It just seemed like an unnecessary step to put it in there. And I just right for the bottle, you know, it's like, that's how I did it, you know? And I love alcohol in this deep way. And it's not like in 2021, there's kind of this idea that we've sort of lost touch with the meaning of certain adjectives in the 2021 social media version of everything. Like now you don't even have to like or love anything. There's just a button for it. You just push the button. Like I love it or I like it or whatever we do. And I want you to know that I don't love or like alcohol in the 2021 version of the word. I love alcohol like in the medieval sense, right? Like, you know, tar and feather me, hit me with the cat of nine tails, pull out my fingernails, but give me another drink, right? I love alcohol. And when you look at the end of my drinking, the kind of torture that I put myself and others through, it was a bit medieval. It was bad. And I never intended it to be that way. I don't even know how I got there. And so I never knew what was going on. My alcoholic life always seemed the only normal one, even before I took my first drink. And I grew up, or I come from this small farming and agricultural community in central Illinois. It's kind of midway between St. Louis and Chicago. It's a little factory town, blue collar town. Its claim to fame is that it's the soybean capital of the world. And it's the former home of the Chicago Bears. And it's like all downhill from there. Like, we used to have this old sign that was the former home of the Chicago, and no one had like maintenance painted this sign in years. It was sad. Like, a tree branch had grown over it, but it was our town pride. And then that soybean refinery, all these plumes of like exhaust would come out. And if you were downwind from that thing, it was not pleasant. And like on a summer afternoon, and everyone used to say, oh, that's the smell of money. Well, smelled like something else to me. And I just remember I played sports growing up, and all the teams from the neighboring towns hated to come play at our ball field because it was like downwind from that refinery, and they couldn't stand it. And they'd make fun of us. And I think when I realized that was my home, that was my first resentment. Like, when I realized, okay, this is where I'm from. How did I end up here? And, you know, as a kid, I had these things, these feelings or experiences, like, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I finally had the heart to open up to it, it gave me words, explanation, and understanding for so many things that I previously couldn't account. Like, how many times I would read the words restless, irritable, and discontent. I never had access to those words, but my God, did I know what they were talking about? You know, did I know what they were talking about? And the feelings of separation and the partners. I mean, as a kid, when I was playing, when I was inside, I wanted to be outside. When I was outside, I wanted to be inside. When I was upstairs, I wanted to be downstairs. When I was downstairs, I wanted to be upstairs. When I was playing soccer, I wanted to be playing baseball. When I'm playing baseball, I wanted to be playing soccer. And I could never find my place. You know, my sponsor describes it as, he could never tell you what was wrong. He could just tell you that nothing was quite right. And I, man, that sums it up for me. I know what he means when he says that. And that's the way I was. I don't know as a kid there's any other way to be. It just seems that's the hand I've been dealt. I was a hardened cynic by the age of 8. You know, I remember there's this old movie. And they take this kid to see a therapist. It's a comedy, and he's sitting in like the waiting room, and they don't know what's wrong with him. The kid, he won't do his homework. He won't do any. He's just over it, right? And they ask him what was wrong, and they said, well, in science class, he had learned that the universe is expanding, and one day it'll break apart. So if that's the case, what's the point in any of this? You know, it was for him, it was over. Life ended there. There's no point in going to school. And I get that. Like, wow, that's it. There's hunger in Africa. Forget it. What's the point of any of this? I had a cynical world. Like, you could have put me at the age of 8 or 9 at the end of one of those like bars where a bunch of middle-aged divorced men are bewailing the institution of marriage, and I would have fit right in, man. You know, just the weight of the world was on me. And I didn't know that there was any other way. It just felt that's the way my life was. And I'll share something else about that environment, but I want to qualify up front that what I'm about to share is not why I'm an alcoholic. It's just part of my story. And I've struggled putting it in the proper perspective. There have been times in my life where I've diminished it to irrelevance. And there's been times in my drinking where I exaggerated it to act kind of like a blank check to behave however I wanted. And I grew up in an alcoholic household. My old man was the hardest drinking man I ever knew. He was my hero. I was conflicted. He was a Vietnam War veteran. He was in the Air Force. And you put that guy in his uniform, he looked like $1 million. You know, he looked like my hero. The guy taught me how to throw and catch a baseball. You know, he liked to work on old cars. I remember he'd be out in the garage and he'd work on those old cars. He was a trumpet player in a jazz band. And I remember the first time I ever heard like Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, like music that I love today, he'd have that music on when he was working on those cars. And I loved that guy. He was charismatic. He was funny. But his life started to change. You know, he would experience these brief periods of recovery followed by even worse relapse. And then from year to year, those cars in the garage weren't in the garage anymore, and they weren't getting finished. Now maybe there was one or two of them on the side of the house, and the weeds were growing up around him. You know, he had started the retreat, and his military career was his pride. It was his everything. And at one point, he was on a training, and I guess on a night out, he got in an accident with a few other cars. There was like a 3 or 4 car pileup, and somebody died in that accident. And as a result, his military career was somewhat derailed, and he would return back, you know, with the one thing that sort of defined him taken away. And I believe any work or any hard work done with a sense of purpose and gratitude is honorable. If I can give, you know, an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, I think it's a beautiful thing. But my old man ended up working on the line in the tire factory, and he didn't do it with a sense of honor. He did it with a sense of bitter resentment at, you know, it was a place where he could go to work. They wouldn't ask him questions about his drinking, and that worked just fine for him, you know, and that's the way it was. And I saw him do something that I would ultimately see myself do, where I would trade and exchange every hope, every dream, every ambition that I ever had for one more drink. I would start to like design my life, not even voluntarily, maybe sometimes it'd be done for me, to defend my right to drink until all that was left in my life was drinking. And that's what happened to my old man. And he came over to see me one day, and you could kind of describe me as like Newton's law of motion as a young kid. An object in motion stays in motion until it comes in contact with a greater force. And the way I am, I'm that kid, nothing quite fits. It seems like I'm living inside of a fishbowl, and I'm in here all by myself. And I'm looking through that fishbowl, and outside there's all of you. And like Clancy so perfectly says, it seems like you guys have something, or you know something that I don't know. Because I could never match the way I felt on the inside with the way that all of you looked on the outside. You just seemed to know something I didn't. A buddy of mine, he plays poker for a living in Vegas, and he says, Henry, if you're ever at the poker table, which I'm not, because I'm a really sore, I'm just a bad loser. I don't have a disposition for it. But he says, if you're ever at the poker table and you don't know who the sucker is, you're the sucker. And I was like, well, that's how I've always felt in life. Like I'm looking around for the sucker. I know I'm it. I know I'm the sucker, you know, and that's how I was as a kid. And that kid would come in contact with two things when I was 12 years old that would change the course and trajectory of my life forever. My old man would come to see me one morning, and he told me he was going away for a while, which wasn't uncommon because he often would. He was still in the military reserves, and he would go away for those weekend training camps. Except that day when he left me, he didn't go away. He went home to this little apartment he was living in after my mother kicked him out. He sat down in an armchair. He put a gun to his chest and he pulled the trigger. He killed himself. And I share with you that to share with you this. I didn't know what to do with that at the age of 12. But through Alcoholics Anonymous, I've come to discover that's just the next thing. That's just the next thing. I think my old man ended up in a place that I and many of us end up. Bill writes about it in A Vision for You. I think my old man ended up at the end of this long hallway All his hopes and dreams and all the lines he would never cross were lined up behind him like railroad tracks. And he only saw two equally unacceptable alternatives in front of him. One, he could go on drinking, you know, trying to blot out his intolerable existence one more day. Knew he couldn't do that anymore. But the only problem is the other door was even worse, living sober. How do you live sober? How do you do that? And I think he and so many of us that die by our own hand, we're just looking for door number three. We just can't take it anymore. And I think that's what happened to my father. And as an aside, I was sort of a depressive, cynical type, and I would always hold on to the idea of suicide and, you know, whatever. And my sponsors ruin everything. My sponsor ruined it for me. They ruin everything. And I'm talking to him about it one time. I'm like, oh, things are really bad. You know, my father committed suicide. He goes, oh, suicide. He goes, Henry, what makes you think that's an answer for a guy like you? I'm like, well, what do you mean? And we're at his home group, and there's a guy in his home group who is, let's just say he's a little excitable. He's like an AA fanatic. You know, he kind of runs around like he's the AA police, and he barks at everybody. He's like one of those guys. I'm sure there's nobody like that in your home group, but he's this guy. And Bob looks at me and goes, huh, you committed suicide. He goes, knowing your luck, you'll end up in some alternative dimension, and that guy will be your sponsor. And it hit me. I was like, oh my God, it could get worse. You know, so that idea went off the table real quick. And I thought, yeah, maybe he's right. You know, maybe he's right. So with my old man, that happened. And so that would change my life. And then the other thing that would happen to me at 12 was that for the first time ever, this spiritual malady I suffered from would come in contact with the most perfect and pure solution that I didn't even know existed. I'd feel the effect produced by alcohol for the first time. Around that time, my mother started to work the night shift to keep the family together and put food on the table. And I remember as a kid feeling a great sense of shame that my mother had to work two jobs or work the night shift just to keep the lights on. And all the other families would be going away for summer vacation and we'd stay behind because mom had to work. And it's amazing the rearrangement that Alcoholics Anonymous will do. It will literally rewrite my entire life story. Because now the sense of appreciation, admiration, love, and respect I have for my mother is beyond explanation. The sacrifices that she made and what she did were incredible, but I couldn't see it at the time. And so our home is like unsupervised in the evenings. So as a result, my sister, she's a few years older than me, 3 or 4 years older, and she's my arch enemy, right? Her and her bratty little friends, it's like the Hatfields and the McCoys, right? I can't stand any of them, you know? But she starts having these parties and I start coming of a certain age. You know, when you turn to be 12 or 13, you start to look at maybe members of the opposite sex a little bit different. And I start to realize that maybe some of her bratty little friends, maybe they're not so bratty after all, you know, and maybe I'd like to get to know them. And I'm not, you know, a complete idiot. And I know a good opportunity for blackmail when I see one. So I corner my sister and I say, listen, I know what you're doing. And if you don't let me in on the action, I'm going to rat you out to mom and the gig will be up, you know? And so I worm my way into an invite to the next party. And, oh man, I remember this thing. It was like, man, my sister, she was like a 1980s hair band, rock and roller, you know, Trans Am, Aquanet, the whole nine. And remember that going on? And they had this big bowl where the kids from the neighborhood or whoever could bring what they could bring would come over and pour it in there. I remember this. I don't know why this is. I remembered this recently, but there was a guy. He was our plug. He was our access to alcohol. We would see him walking up and down the two-way highway. And one day somebody said, listen, maybe if we pick that old wino up and give him a ride to the liquor store, he'll buy booze for us. And so sure enough, we did. We gave him a ride. We called him Uncle Bob, and we would take Uncle Bob to the store, give him a few extra dollars. He'd get us our booze. And we loved Uncle Bob until one of the parties got busted and somebody ratted out Uncle Bob. And then there went our hookup. So that was gone. But I remember they had this punch bowl and there was like, you know, Mad Dog 2020. Somebody put in some Boone's Farm. there was this stuff. I don't even think like they allow it anymore, but it was pure grain alcohol and food coloring. It was called Purple Passion. Oh, they poured all that stuff in there. And I just remember they gave me one of those plastic cups full of it. And when I took it, I don't even think I knew what it was. Like, I don't even think I knew, oh, I'm going to take this and I'm going to get drunk. I just saw everybody else doing it. And see, secretly inside, I feel like I'm nothing. But I look out at them and they got something going on. They're dancing with girls. They're talking. They're having fun. And it looks like they have something. So maybe if I do what they do, some of their something will rub off on my nothing. And so I take that cup and I drink it down. And man, talk about a spiritual experience. The alcohol went down and deep inside of me, wrapped itself around every raw exposed nerve. And that fishbowl evaporated and I could come out and play. And so all of a sudden, I didn't care anymore that I was from the wrong side of the tracks or that my old man was a drunk or that my mom had to work the night shift. Didn't matter. It didn't matter. All that stuff was gone. And so I had my first drink, as I said, at the age of 12 and my last drink at the age of 33. And I could sum up the rest of my drinking with one of my favorite lines in the book. Eventually things got worse. Like that was it. That was the pinnacle and things got worse. But I'll kind of like sum it up like this. And this is how my drinking career went. Again, I think in the early days, it saved my life. There's no question. Like it really resolved something in me that needed resolving. The effect would be so good that the way I would feel without it would never be good enough again. It was everything. And I remember I had this realization. I live in Miami, but my parents are up in Central Florida in near Orlando. And through AA, I've redeveloped a relationship with them. I was estranged from most of my family for a little over a decade. I just kind of wrote them off and sailed out, went out west and kind of denied them or pretended they didn't exist. I had whole relationships where I had a lie that I was orphaned. Like, it was like, you're not meeting my family. This is just the easier way. All right, that's it. Oliver Twist, you know, more soup, please. I'm orphaned. That's the way it is, you know? And I've forgotten about that. And you start to live a lie so long, you can't separate the true from the false. You don't know what's real anymore. And so I'm have this relationship with my mother and they're up in Central Florida. And my sister is one of these like fans of, she likes these theme parks, you know, Universal Studios, Walt Disney World. And so I'm a good sport. I'm going to tag along. And so we all get together and go over to Disney World. You know, some people call it the happiest place on earth. I don't know, depending on which toddlers you're with, it could be the most annoying place on earth, but I'll reserve my opinion for now. But people love it. People love it, man. And I remember standing there and watching, you realize like, I take it for granted, but there are families and there are people and they literally save for years to bring the family over to have this experience. It's powerful. And you look at their faces as they're walking into the happiest place on earth and they see hope and they see possibility and they have arrived. And it occurred to me that the way Disney World makes those people feel is kind of like alcohol made me feel. It was the happiest place on earth for me, drinking was. And for a long time, my drinking was like going to Disney World. But then eventually things got worse. And then my drinking wasn't so much like going to Disney World anymore. It was more like a sketchy carnival in a church parking lot. You know, it's like, I shouldn't do this. There's some guy with tattoos, no teeth and warrants for his arrest. And I'm like, ugh, maybe I shouldn't. All right, put me on the tilt-a-whirl. Let's go. You know, and I did that for a long time. And then eventually my drinking got worse. And it wasn't even like a sketchy carnival. It was like one of those motorized horses in front of Walmart, and I'm just rocking back and forth, you know? And then eventually somebody comes over and unplugs the horse, and now there's no power left, and I'm sitting on a dead horse. And occasionally some concerned citizen walks up and says, kid, are you okay? And I look back all wild-eyed saying, I'm going to Disney World, and I'm going nowhere. And I've got no clue that I've got no clue. And I'm on the dead horse trying to restart the feeling that I once had. the power and the effect, the great obsession, somehow, someday, some way, I will once again control it and enjoy it. And the truth is, if I was ever controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And if I was enjoying it, there was no control whatsoever, you know? And that's that. And there was a lot of destruction around my drinking, and it got bad. Looking back and connect the dots that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. God was with me the whole time, this power. And so I had gone in and out of AA for the better part of half a decade. And kind of a turning point for me was I had a friend, and he knew and had heard that I was in a pretty bad way. So he kind of wanted to fish me out of where I was living. I was out in the hitting bottom capital of the world, Las Vegas. I was out there doing some drinking. And he'd heard I was in a jam. I had helped him early on get started in business. So as a result, you know, he kind of felt an allegiance to me. And he ended up kind of fishing me out of Las Vegas only to bring me to Miami, where I would continue the same thing. And if you've ever played chess, one of the ways that kind of they teach you how to play is they'll start with these end game scenarios, and then they'll work backward to show you how you got there. In my end game scenario with alcohol was around the middle of 2011. I'd been in and out for a long time by then, half a decade maybe. And I'd come to a place where I didn't even imagine that things could get any worse. And then I'd go on to drink years later. And I reached a level of depth and despair that I can't even describe. And I was living in this little box in the sky overlooking the Atlantic Ocean, but you wouldn't have known it because the shades had been drawn for months. I might as well have been living in a storage unit or a closet. The only outfit I could put on was an old dirty bathrobe. And isn't it unfair? Like when you wear a bathrobe indoors, you feel luxurious. But when you wear one out in public, you look like a psychopath. Like, you know, it was a bathrobe. I put my bathrobe on. And I had to realize like the honest reason why I wore the bathrobe, all joking aside, was that I had begun to lose my faculties. There were times where I'd try and put pants on and I'd completely fall over. And the side of my body was bruised, you know, from my shoulder all the way down to my ankle. And I was jittery. I was at the end stages of alcoholism. I didn't even know it. I didn't know how far I'd gone, but I was jaundiced. I was bloated. My life was something like I'd come to, and I'd frantically reach for the bedside, hoping there was some half empty bottle, you know, that maybe I could get a pull from. If there wasn't that, I'd kind of stumble over to the sink in the kitchen, and I'd lean over that sink and I would dry heave until it felt like my eyes were going to pop out. And I would pass this line of madness. I would come to in my mind and everything would be screaming at me. I felt like I was going insane, which was true, but I still couldn't connect the dots. And then eventually I had this old pair of running shoes that I'd fished the shoelaces out of, and I'd stuff my feet in there like an old pair of house slippers, and I'd mosey on down to this bodega in the lobby of my building to buy my medicine, to buy my alcohol one more time. And if you saw me, if you were taking your children to school and you saw me coming, you would have given me a wide berth, and I could just feel the whispers and the stares and the criticisms. And you could see sort of the fear in people's eyes as you're walking along. You almost feel inhuman. You know, you almost feel like there's no, you're just wasting air, like there's no purpose. And I'd get the medicine. And I'd get that medicine, I'd go back up to my hole, and I would try and drink a little bit down. But my body was so poisoned that I would reject the first few drinks. And then by some grace of God, I'd be able to drink and keep a couple drinks down. And then that alcohol would go inside and do what it always did. It would restore me to sanity. The alcohol would settle the madness temporarily, artificially, and synthetically. It would restore me to sanity. No wonder I kept going back to it. And when I got square on what alcohol was for me, my power by which to live, it helped me understand a different understanding of what I'm doing here. See, it's my experience that if you're looking for an answer, it's helpful to know what the problem is. See, my whole life, it's like I've been driving around the streets of Chicago with a map of Detroit, and I can't make a correct turn. Now, it never occurs to me to get a new map. I want to get out of the car and rearrange the buildings to fit my map. Well, my sponsor describes that as arguing with the truth. And he says people who argue with the truth get sick. I argue with the truth. And as a result, I got sick. I got sick. And so the universe and God sends us messengers in the most bizarre ways. Now, I'm not sure up in your area if air conditioning is a big deal in July, but in Miami, air conditioning is a piece of business in July. If you don't have it, there's a problem. And I had that thing down to like meat locker levels, right? And I don't connect the dots that I'm physically addicted to alcohol. I'm sweating profusely, like 24 hours a day, and I'm shaking. And like, I like my AC down to where I can almost see my breath, you know, like nice and cold, but I'm still sweating. So it occurs to me that there must be something wrong with the air conditioning. I couldn't have anything to do with my drinking. The AC's got to be faulty. So apparently somewhere along the line, I called for an air conditioning service call. And I remember one day, this guy shows up. His name is Fernando. He's a Cuban AC repair guy. He's like the approved vendor for our condo. And Fernando would come in that day, and he would find me unresponsive on the kitchen floor. Now, if he doesn't show up on that day, I don't know what happens. Maybe it would have been like my former sponsee, Jonathan. Jonathan just drank until one day he never came to. He just slipped into an alcoholic coma and passed away. I don't know. Maybe that would have happened. Or maybe like Bobby. Bobby passed out, but his body was so polluted that he threw up in his sleep and choked on his own vomit. Maybe that would have happened. We've seen that happen. I don't know what would have happened. But on that day, you know, Fernando comes in and inspects me with his work boot. He just starts kicking me, I think, to see if I'm alive or something. And it must have been like one of those funeral home prank shows, because I guess I just shoot up off the floor, like, you know, look mine at grand, the wind stopped blowing. And I like, you know, and I take him right over to the AC closet and pour myself another drink. Because the most important thing in the world to me is that nobody knows I'm an alcoholic. Most importantly, me. Most importantly, me. I'm punking myself out again. And, you know, Fernando is funny. He doesn't speak very good English, but when he sees me, he still looks at me strange to this day. I think he's still a little bit like, you know, who is this guy? You know, what happened there? And but we've had a few laughs about it in my broken Spanish and his broken English. But thank God he came. Thank God he came. And that would start a journey for me. It would start a journey for me of crawling drunk and dying back into AA one more time. And I remember I would come here and I was down in Miami and I started going to meetings again. And if you're new or you're making your approach again and you're not in love with AA, I can relate. I didn't love AA at first. I warmed up to it. In fact, I didn't like it at all. Like I had one experience. I was about 60 days sober, and I've had this experience, and I'll share it because it made me feel like I didn't belong here. Or at very least, if any of you found out what I was thinking, you'd ask me to leave. You know, that's what I was really afraid of, is that if there were the thought police, I would be banned. And I'm sitting in this meeting, and it's one of these like meetings where there's a chairperson, they do a topic, and then boom, you know, it's raised hand sharing or whatever. And there's this woman in this meeting. She shares every single meeting. And I already know what she's going to say. I can already finish her share. And I've got about 60 days and I'm in the back row with my arms crossed. I don't like any of you, but I'm here. If I don't come here, my girlfriend's going to kick me out again. So that's why I'm here. I just want you to know I don't have a problem. You have a problem, but I'm here because of that. And that's why I'm here. And I'm sitting there. And sure enough, they open up the meeting and boom, her hand goes up. you know, and you know, she says, I have 60 days today. Man, everybody starts clapping. In AA, we just like to clap for everything. Like a chair falls over. We just start clapping, you know, we love to clap. And oh man, I couldn't stand it. And she was excited about her 60 days. I'm like, well, I've got about 60 days, you know? And then she goes on to say, I just want everybody to know, I, you know, with my drinking, my marriage was troubled and my husband had moved out. But I want you to know that in 60 days, thanks to God and AA, my husband's home again and the family's back together. Thank you, God and AA. And everybody starts clapping and gets excited. And then she goes, I want you to know also that my job that I was written up, you know, and she goes, but now they see how good I'm doing and I'm up for a promotion. Thank you, God and AA. And everybody gets excited. And she goes, and my children, my son, he applied to colleges and he's going to get a scholarship to not one, but two different colleges. Thank you, God and AA. And everyone's excited and clapping. And I'm sitting back there going, 60 days, that ain't my story. Right. My life's falling apart. Right. I didn't get a promotion at work. Nothing's going right for me. But then I think, well, maybe there's justice in the world. It's like maybe this woman shouldn't get too happy. Maybe when she goes home tonight, she'll find her husband in bed with a mistress. Then will she see how happy she is. You know, maybe she'll go to work and they're going to fire her anyway. And then maybe her kid will go to college and flunk out his first year. Then we'll see how much she loves God and AA. And I just took like a lot of satisfaction and I'm going to keep coming back to see if that happens to her. Cause that would be justice, you know? And that was me and I was terrible. And you were all so nice to me and kind to me. Some of you know, there's people will say sometimes in meetings that, you know, we're going to love you till you can love yourself. But in my sponsors group, they say, nah, we're going to laugh at you until you can laugh at yourself. You know, and I think that is more accurate because isn't laughter maybe the soundtrack of a spiritual awakening, right? Isn't that the lightness and what you hear that guides us? And so that's what I brought to the table. That's what you guys were working with. I was obstinate. I had false intellectual pride. I had no idea what was going on. And my first year, I really think my step two and three experience happened through a relationship with a sponsor named Andy. And I love Andy. And I mentioned him recently because he's come to mind so much. And I'd been in and out and I thought I knew the game and I wasn't really convinced AA would work for me. I saw some people staying sober and I just thought that I had an issue that was beyond help. I thought that there was no hope for me. And Andy kind of took me under his wing and he was kind to me. And Andy, really what he did is he showed me something attractive in AA. And, you know, I know I've heard people say, and I used to get confused by this, where they said, you know, we don't put people on pedestals in AA. And I understand what they mean, that we all have clay feet and none of us are infallible. But I got to tell you, I've got AA heroes. And I had to have heroes in AA because I couldn't give my life to something I didn't respect. I couldn't give my life to something I didn't respect. And I trust my sponsor today. One of the best things that ever happened to me was getting around the people I love in AA and realizing how human and flawed they are. Like, I think I got closer to my sponsor when I saw him get like upset and angry once that I ever did when I used to see him. He'd like float 3 feet off the ground. You know, he was so heavenly. I saw him be like really human. And I was like, oh, okay, this guy's like me. You know, he's real. But what happens is AA allows him to transcend that one day at a time. AA allows me to be free of that. And that's the beauty. And Andy was just a guy who showed me how to have a great life. He was a guy I admired. He was a, you know, a big Wall Street guy and he had this huge, huge financial firm. And yet he would still make time to meet with me. And he'd sit and have a cup of coffee with me on a Saturday morning. And we'd go to the Saturday morning beach meeting over on Miami Beach. And we'd all meet at this Starbucks on 15th and Ocean and get our coffees and walk out a little off of this lifeguard stand. And you'd see a little circle there forming and everyone would sit down and we'd have a meeting and you'd start to watch the sunrise over the ocean and you'd see that great ball of fire sort of flood Miami Beach with all those pastel colors. And it was beautiful. It was an incredible experience. And so I started to see something maybe was here. And Andy showed me that you could have an amazing life, the kind of life that that I was attracted to, a life, frankly, that was better than anything I ever conceived when I was drinking. And he took time for me. But then Andy and I got a little too close. We started doing some business stuff together. So I lost the objectivity. I was no longer able to hear him, and I wasn't telling him everything about my life. I wasn't getting current with him. And we'd have the full spectrum of experiences. Andy and I would get close. And then a few years later, around 2015, 16, one of our business deals went bad. And I hated Andy for a while. I wanted him dead. And I think in AA, we might call that a jumbo size resentment. I harbored one of those. And man, I treated it like a chia pet. I was just watering that thing like, oh, this is my baby. I'm going to get some good mileage out of this. And until literally I was with my sponsor, we'll be there in June, in like 2016, 17. And from this resentment, I was literally starting to retreat back into my old patterns of anxiety and separation to the point where the resentment was paralyzing. And then eventually Andy and I would make it right. And he would come out and go to my sponsor's home group and make amends. And I made amends and we patched it up. Prior to the pandemic, I was working about a week a month in New York City, back and forth to Miami. And Andy and I got close. I'd work out of his office on 58th and Park, and we'd have lunches together. And I want to believe through my experience that Andy and I got closer than we could ever get. He and his wife were never able to have children biologically. So he was really like a father figure to me. I love this man. And then I remember after the pandemic, he was decided that he was going to come quarantine down in Miami. And he called me one day and said, hey man, I'm going to come down for a while. Why don't we go see if that old beach meeting's still going? You know, and we joked that we don't think it's still going because it's impossible that any meeting would survive without us. You know, like if we left, the whole thing was going to collapse, you know, and we made plans to go to that beach meeting. And then he called me the next day saying he wasn't feeling well. And he had a little cough, and he said he was just going to go in and get checked up just in case. And he was going to the emergency room. And I remember I was on the phone with him when he was going into the emergency room, and Andy had some underlying conditions. He lived with chronic lymphatic leukemia, and he had a few things. Andy would go into that emergency room, and that'd be the last phone call I had with him. They put him in a medically induced coma, and he never came out of it. He passed away. And, you know, I don't know if the people in AA come in our lives for a season, a reason, or a lifetime, but Andy was a messenger for me. Andy showed me something, a beginnings of something that I could hold on to. And for some reason, he's been with me in my mind and my heart a lot. And about a year and a half in, I'm continuing on, but I'm failing to enlarge and perfect my spiritual life. I'm kind of around AA again, and I'm on my way out the door, and I don't even know it. And so I'm out in Las Vegas on that Christmas holiday with my girlfriend. And, you know, girlfriend, it's an exaggeration. We were really like, you know, 6 years into a one night stand, you know, where you just kind of wake up in the morning, you look at each other and you're like, are we still doing this? And then like the calendar turns over and like, okay, another year. But I have to tell you that God does incredible work, because that young lady who, you know, God ended up putting us where we both belonged. And she was able to find and meet the kind of man that she always wanted, the kind of man that would fulfill all the empty promises that I made. And before, you know, she got married, we were able to connect, and everything was right with us. The everything was clear. And God has an incredible sense of humor. You know, takes the most selfish and self-centered people in the world, puts them all in one 12-step program, and then our very lives depend on helping each other. Like what is that about? Like, what's that deal? And so after I get sober, all of my drinking and nonsense separate from her, she discovers that maybe her drinking's a little out of control, and she finds out that she's an alcoholic too. Well, if God didn't have enough of a sense of humor, she ends up getting sober and getting a sponsor in my sponsor's home group. So now she's a member of my, I just shudder at the idea when I go there that some woman in that group has heard her fifth step, right? And they know who I really am. You know, I know they all think less of me. You know, I can just feel it, you know, but I'm out there with her, and I'm going crazy, and I know I'm going to drink again. I know something's going to happen. And so I make a pact with myself that I'll drink when I go back to Miami. And you know that feeling, you don't even have the booze yet, but just knowing that it's coming, you get a little bit of relief, just knowing that it's coming. And I'm there and it's Friday night and I'm going back the next Monday and I can't take it anymore. So in a last ditch effort, I make a phone call to the central office and they give me the address of a meeting. And if you've ever been to Vegas, you got the Las Vegas Strip. And then on the north end, you've got Fremont Street. And kind of in between, there's this tall hotel tower called the Stratosphere. And a few blocks east of the Stratosphere, there's a street corner, 6th and St. Louis. And on that street corner, there's a Lutheran church. And I go up to that meeting. And I think I'm going to the meeting the way I normally go to went to meetings back in those days. I like to go 5 minutes late. 5 minutes late is good. You guys have already taken your seats. Someone's reading how it works. The coffee bar's wide open. I can sort of do my own thing. I don't have to talk to any of you people. But I go to this meeting and I messed up. I'm not 5 minutes late. I'm 55 minutes early. And you know the kind of AA fanatics that are there 55 minutes. Guys like Al Jay and his crew. They're there. Oh, my God. And I go up to this meeting and they spot me. They see me coming. So now I can't like turn around and leave. And oh God, I walk up to this thing and I see a guy in the doorway and he's wearing this over. He kind of looks like an undertaker, which was appropriate for how I was feeling. But he puts his hand out and he goes, "Hey, my name's Bob. How are you?" And he starts talking to me. And I'm not saying that he told me anything or said anything that others hadn't tried to before. But maybe it's like the Buddhists say that when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And this guy was able to thread my needle. What he was saying for the first time I could hear. And so that guy would begin to talk to me. And I asked him to sponsor me. And he gave me some, what seemed at the time like some unreasonable requests, you know, like call him regularly on these set days at these set times, you know. And he gave me some assignments to do. And I'm like, I don't want any more homework. Who does this guy think he is, you know? And then he wanted me to get into service work. And he started pushing me into all these actions and actions I didn't believe in, actions I didn't think were going to work, but actions that gave me results I couldn't deny. Actions that gave me results I couldn't deny. And then ultimately in taking those actions, I would come to find out the truth. The reason I think I'm here is very different than the reason I'm actually here. And it turns out I'm like what Clancy described. See, I'm a chronic alcoholic. A chronic alcoholic like me is not someone whose problem is alcohol. A chronic alcoholic like me is someone whose answer or solution is alcohol. So if alcohol is my answer, what in the heck is the question? What's the question? Well, I got to find a way to get the effect produced, that awe-inspiring effect produced through my actions in AA, through all my actions in AA. And so as the journey's gone on, I've stayed close to all of you, and it's been incredible to meet you guys and these pockets of enthusiasm in other places. And if you guys are ever down this way in Miami, you know, you guys all have a home away from home group. You know, we'd absolutely love to have you. And I know one thing for sure. I don't know much, but I truly believe based on my experience that as the world, it feels like the game board of the world has kind of been flipped over in the last year and a half and all the rules have been changed. But one thing has remained the same. We're very lucky that we're able to meet live again at our home group. We take precautions and we follow local guidelines, but we're live again. And every time I walk in and I feel the connection and energy of that group, just like I'm sitting with all of you here today, I know one thing for sure. I know one thing for sure, that my name is Henry Murphy and I'm an alcoholic. And I know that as I stay close to you guys, the odds are real, real good that I'll get to experience another day on the broad highway with all of you. But thanks so much for having me, and thanks for listening.